Good morning. We're delighted to welcome this morning two high school groups. One is Deerfield High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And the other is it Preble or Preble? Preble High School. Would those students please stand? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. This program invites high school students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to do that, they are sent copies of the brief and may do some activities related to the case. They then come for oral argument and will meet with a justice of this court at noon. At that time, the court or the justice will talk about the proceedings in this court to accept and hear cases and decide them. There will be no discussion about the substantive issues involved in this case. Everyone is invited to come, not only the students, but anyone else in the courtroom. Does anyone need a summary of this case? If so, the marshal has them. I assume the students have the briefs. Anyone want a summary? All right. Then that is what I have to say about the students, and they are certainly welcome here. Before we turn to the first case we're going to hear today, let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack, and you will be meeting with Justice Rogensack at noon today. You may be joined by students from other institutions. We turn to our first case in the October arguments, 05AP2315, Holly Lawrenson versus, and how do you pronounce the defendant's name, Siddiqui? Okay. Representing the plaintiffs, Holly Lawrenson et al., is Lynn R. Laufenberg. Mr. Laufenberg, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. My name is Lynn Laufenberg, and I have the privilege of presenting this case on behalf of Kim Hirsch and Holly Lawrenson, who are the daughters of Janice and Joseph Sanders and the appellants on this appeal. The question presented for your decision on this appeal is whether, in granting the spouse of a patient injured by malpractice a right to recover damages, the legislature intended that the right of recovery of those damages actually incurred should disappear with the happenstance of the spouse's death before the case and the claim could be reduced to judgment through trial. We submit that there was no such legislative intent, and in fact, the result reached by the trial court and argued by the defendant's respondents in this case is contrary to A, the letter of the applicable statutes, 655.007 and 895.01, B, the legislative policy underlying Chapter 655, which is to provide compensation to those injured by malpractice and to deter substandard practice of medicine, and C, the demonstrated legislative policy, which over the years has disfavored the ancient common law principle of abatement. The construction adopted by the trial court and urged in this court by the defendant's respondents produces absurd results and, if adopted, quite frankly, would raise significant constitutional questions.
One of those absurd results be it depend upon if the claim has never been litigated. Just on the compendium would be never in trial, all completed but up on appeal. Does that make any difference?
It shouldn't, but it would under the arguments made by the defendant's respondents, because quite frankly, until there's a final judgment in a case in favor of a party, and let's just take an example. If this case had been tried to verdict in January or February of 2005, which it could have been, there was a delay in the processing of this case in the trial court because a party had to be added as a defendant as discovery progressed. So we didn't have a trial date until November of 2005. But let's just assume that the same case had been brought on behalf of Mr. Sanders for the loss of his wife's society and companionship and the pecuniary value of her services and the benefits that she was receiving through her Social Security disability. Let's assume that case had actually been tried to verdict in February of 2005 and not appealed and a judgment entered on that verdict. There would be no question. And then let's assume that Mr. Sanders, as he did, unfortunately, died in April of 2005. There would be no question that the estate of Mr. Sanders would have the benefit of the judgment. More than that, the judgment would likely have included an assessment of damages for Mr. Sanders, not only up to the time of trial in February of 2005 under our hypothetical, but also for the future years of his life that the jury might conclude that he would have survived beyond the trial, the continued loss of his wife's society and companionship and the continued value of her pecuniary contributions to the household. And indeed, because of his death, he would never have suffered all of that damage. Yet, there would be no argument, and could be no argument, that his estate, the primary beneficiaries of which would be his and his wife's adult daughters and their families, would be re-entitled to the payment of that judgment and to receive that judgment in its entirety. And that's what I mean by an absurd result. And now in this instance, even though Mr. Sanders has actually incurred damages in the form of the loss of his wife's society and companionship and the value of her pecuniary services and benefits, from the time of her death, ironically, on October 11th, 2002, exactly 4 years ago today, up to the time of his death of April 3rd of 2005, he suffered loss. There's no question that he did. Yet, the argument being advanced by the defendants in this case would suggest that because he happened to die before that claim could be reduced to judgment, those damages disappear.
Well, Mr. Lochenberg, let me ask you, referring to Section 895.04 sub 2, there's a provision about halfway through the statute, and I'll read it. This is the hierarchical statute that deals with who can file claims for wrongful death. Generally, not necessarily in a Malik case, but generally. If any such relative dies before judgment in the action, the relative next in order shall be entitled to recover for the wrongful death. Now, I bring up this question with Krantz in mind, that I know one of the issues in the case is abatement, whether or not the action abates upon the plaintiff's death in this matter, since this is pre-judgment. Given this statute and the way it's worded, does this statute indicate any change in how Krantz should be viewed, or is this consistent with Krantz that upon the death of an individual pre-judgment, you move down in a hierarchical fashion and his cause of action would end?
Your Honor, actually, Justice Butler, Krantz has very little to do with that particular statutory provision. As the court has...
The common law.
Yes. Krantz was an expression of common law principles. And that's why I brought to the court's attention the Boynton case. I hope that all of the justice had a chance to get my letter that was sent by fax yesterday. I apologize for the delay in getting that case to the court's attention. Is an illustration of number one, there are a couple of principles at play here. Number one, is, as this Court has said many times, wrongful death is a creature of statute. It's not a creature of the common law. Okay? And this Court and the State has had a wrongful death statute of some form for almost as long as it's been a State. Lord Campbell's Act has been in force in this State in one form or another since the origins of our statehood. The present form of the statute, and that which provides for a hierarchy of claimants in a wrongful death claim, which this Court has said the legislature did not intend to be engrafted upon medical malpractice claims. That section of the statute was not intended to be, in the Reinick case, the Court said that wasn't intended to be part of the adoption by the legislature when it adopted the limits in 895.04. But that part of the statute that sets up a hierarchy, interestingly enough, was adopted in 1931, immediately following the Boynton case. Before the Boynton case, there was no hierarchy or apparent survivorship provision for what would happen if the claimant in a wrongful death action would die. That's where the Boynton case becomes important, because we see in the Boynton case that situation, a pre-current form of the death statute where there was no succession set forth. And in Boynton, the widow passed away before the case could be reduced to judgment. And it happened to be a 102.29 action. The death occurred in the course of the husband's employment. And therefore, the workers' comp carrier, which had paid a death benefit, was entitled by statute to recover on a subrogation principle, or 102.29. The Court said that they looked at the old rule of abatement and said, ordinarily, under the ancient common law rule of abatement, this action wouldn't survive the death of the widow. But the statute provides expressly for the statutory assignment of part of her claim to the work comp carrier.
And that gets to the thrust of my question, because if the common law provides that the action abates upon the death of the claimant pre-judgment, I'm looking for the statutory peg that would allow your client to proceed with this action through the estate.
Your Honor, I think the statutory and the common law peg exists both in the Boynton case, which, instead of saying not only doesn't the part of the claim that was owned by the work comp carrier survive, but so does the part of the claim that was available to the widow. It passes to her personal representative in that situation. Now, it could be argued that that was a special situation because there was a statutory assignment under 102.29, which made that case a little different than the normal case. There's no 102.29 situation here. But beyond that, 895.01 sub 1 sub 0, we contend, in its plain language, makes causes of action for wrongful death survive.
Well, you got a problem with that because it refers to the death of the wrongdoer. And I mean, that's where you disagree. Why don't you rely on 895.01G?
Because I think I could, except that I think the counter-argument to that is that that refers to personal injuries that the person himself or person suffered. In other words, the injured party claim.
But my understanding of wrongful death is that it's a compensation for the injury suffered by one of the named relatives for their loss in society and companionship of the decedent. And it's compensation to that named party for their loss, their damage to their interests.
I agree completely, and I don't have any problem if this Court decides to apply that provision to this case, because I do believe that the injury suffered by Joseph Sanders is very personal to him. It's the loss of his wife's society and companionship, as well as the financial benefits that she could have provided.
Mr. Loffenberg, let me ask one other question about the statute 04 sub 2. The concern that I have with the argument that's advanced is the second portion of the sentence that I read, and whether or not that would ever kick in if your argument were to prevail. In other words, if any such relative dies before judgment in the action, the relative next in order shall be entitled to recover for the wrongful death. How does the relative next in order ever get a claim if the estate can proceed upon the death prejudgment?
Because this we're in a medical malpractice case here, and the problem we have in this case is that this court has already held that the next in line relatives, the adult daughters, can't make a claim for the wrongful death of their mother. And the statute says that the claim is not pursued for the damages suffered by the priority claimant, namely the husband, but is instead pursued for the damages that the adult daughters would suffer. And that, frankly, we can't, because of the Reinick and the Schaplinski case, it's already been decided as precedent in this case, they can't assert that claim in a medical malpractice case.
But now they can assert it in the estate. And my follow-up question to my first question is then, is there any, this is maybe more of a public policy consideration, what, if any, cutoff could there be? Could you have a fifth cousin living in England? I mean, is that where we're going here? So there isn't any.
We could have that situation. That doesn't happen to be the situation.
Sure, I understand. But we, unless we say that, I mean, and I don't know of any good reason, once we start extending this, where does this end up?
Well, it would be the same situation, Justice Wilcox, that would exist in the hypothetical I gave you earlier. And that is, if the case had been reduced to judgment before he died and no appeal taken, so it's a final judgment, the value of that judgment would go to his estate. And if it's a fifth cousin in England, that fifth cousin is the beneficiary. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the way the system has always acted, behaved. Yes.
Are the adult children claiming as the heirs and sole beneficiaries of the father?
They're claiming as his personal representative, the personal representative of his estate, to the extent that they would benefit from anything that would be going to his estate from the trial of this case.
His estate, right.
They would get, but that's different than making their own claim for their own loss. They're not doing that because this court has said they can't in a medical malpractice context.
I'm trying to understand your argument. In 655, it covers wrongful death in med mal.
It actually doesn't say wrongful death. It says it identifies the claimants who may make a claim, including the spouse of the injured patient.
Who dies.
That's right. Happens to die, but then it outlines, it adopts in 893.55, I think, a category of damages which are recoverable, which include society and companionship, economic loss, and that sort of thing. So the courts have always treated that situation like a wrongful death claim under 895.04, even though not all of the provisions of that statute apply to a medical malpractice case.
Well, that was my next question. Seems to me your position is that under the cases, 895.04 doesn't apply because 655 governs at least as to who the claimants can be.
That's correct. That's what the case law has been to this point.
Right. So therefore, your position, as if I understand it, is therefore the statute 895.04 that talks about the what happens if one of the named people dies doesn't apply to 655 because the case law says.
So this court held in Reinick and Schaplinski.
Right, doesn't apply. Therefore, we're left with a statute that is silent as to what happens if the claimant dies.
Exactly.
Okay.
We then go to Sawyer versus Middleford, which said we look to the survival statute.
Then you're going to look, your position has to be that 655 doesn't cover that. 655 can't be the exclusive on everything. So you're going to now go to the survivorship, which is 895.01.
Correct.
And that's why you went to O, and I asked you why you should go to G. Would, I'll put it this way, in a survivor action for loss of society and companionship, this is pre-death, right?
Yes.
Okay. Husband has survivor interests for loss of society and companionship pre-death.
Yes.
He dies after she dies and before judgment. Same position as this. Is there any debate between you that the survivor action goes to his estate?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Because.
And where does that come under?
Well, that certainly comes in under sub G. Okay. Of 895.01.
Right. So why, I come back to my question, doesn't the wrongful death come under G? Because it's for loss of society and companionship as recognized by statute. I concede without a wrongful death statute, where you're out. I mean, everybody's out. Yes. Joseph would have been out, too. So it just seems to me it's damage to the person.
I don't disagree with that. I looked at the cases decided under that section, and they all happen to refer to the injury to the person of the person who then dies before the claim can be reduced to judgment.
So, and then this is it. And that's the question. And I will ask you that same question, counsel.
And I might also suggest to the court that, as in Reinick, where the court adopted a principle of law that permitted a minor to recover for the wrongful death of his or her mother caused by malpractice, even though there was a surviving spouse. That's an interesting case because the court believed that that in enacting 655.007, the legislature intended that it didn't say that a child couldn't also recover for a medical malpractice wrongful death action. And therefore, there could be a recovery by both the spouse and the minor child, even though at common law that minor child would not have had a claim for wrongful death, and even though in a non-wrongful death situation the minor child would not be permitted if there was a surviving spouse. The critical point I'm suggesting here is that this court has the authority to recognize the public policy underlying Chapter 655 to provide compensation to victims of malpractice.
Mr. Loffenberg,
deter malpractice conduct. Yes, Justice Butler.
Mr. Loffenberg, 655.007. Is that statute hierarchical, or is that statute, each individual under the statute can have a separate claim at the same time?
This court has held in the Reinick case that at least as between a surviving parent or spouse and a minor child, it's each one of them has their own claim that can be asserted in that situation for their separately incurred damages, different than the non-medical malpractice cause of action for wrongful death.
What would your position be in this case if the husband dies, Joseph dies, and he leaves minor children?
I think if that had been the case when Mrs. Sanders passed away, both the minor children and Mr. Sanders' claims would have been asserted in the original action.
Okay, and now
There would be no difference. I'd still take the position that his claim still exists, as does the minor's case in that situation. But we cannot serve the purpose of Chapter 655.007, which this Court has most recently stated in the Ferdinand and Bartholomew case as having a dual purpose, to provide compensation to victims of malpractice and to deter medical negligence or substandard practice, if we don't permit recovery of damages that are actually incurred. And the ancient rule of abatement, which has been clearly disfavored by the legislature, as demonstrated by the defendant's respondent's brief, every time this Court applied that rule in the cases leading up to 1935 or so, the legislature immediately acted to get beyond the court's application of that rule. And the extent of the number of cases that are, by the survival statute, number of claims that are held to survive reflect a clear social policy in this state that the old ancient rule of abatement that survives from English common law really is out of date with common times and is represented by the Boynton case, where it wasn't applied to the widow's part of the 102.29 claim, even though technically it could have prevented her from asserting that claim. I think the appropriate result in this case is that the court could say that the old common law rule of abatement must yield to the public policy of the legislature, reflected by Chapter 655, which is to provide compensation to those who are actually injured by malpractice and to deter negligent conduct.
Counselor, I want you to look a little bit at 895.01, subsection O, which talks about the survival of a wrongful death action when the wrongdoer dies. Now, as been pointed out by my colleagues, we don't have the death of a wrongdoer here. But my concern with the statute and the arguments that are going back and forth about how do we continue the 655 claim beyond the death of the husband and into the estate, focus on that a little bit, because if the legislator wanted both the injured person and the wrongdoer's death to be a condition that didn't affect the claim, why didn't they say so in that statute, which speaks very specifically to a wrongful death claim?
It could be because in enacting Chapter 655, the legislature didn't realize that it wasn't incorporating the hierarchical succession of claims that is in the wrongful death, general wrongful death statute. But my position on that, Justice Rogensack, is that I am not a grammarian, but I consulted a grammarian and I looked at the rules of grammar, and the statute on its face says, if you read it, in addition to the causes of action that survive at common law, all of the following also survive. Sub O, causes of action for wrongful death, comma, and then there's a special qualification or reference to what happens to the death of the defendant. And so I think the sentence is complete. Causes of action for wrongful death. And on its face, plain language, and I know there's a debate about what we do to interpret statutes, but on its face, all causes of action for wrongful death survive.
I have a question about 011. All of those relate to the plaintiff.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because the following action, causes of action to determine paternity. If the defendant dies, doesn't it come under 2? An action does not abate by the occurrence of any event if the cause of action survives?
Yeah, I think it should, but there's this historical development of subsection O that the defendant's respondents go through in their brief that explain why the language is in that subsection.
And there were some cases that would indicate that if the wrongdoer died before the claim was completed, it abated.
That's correct.
So they put this in to fix up a case.
That's correct. Initially, that was the purpose. Then when they changed the way that it was the language read, it obviously on its face applies to all causes of action, as you have referenced, Justice Abrahamson. All of the other subsections of sub 1 refer obviously to the plaintiff's claim in various categories. And I suggest that consistent with that, sub O likewise refers to the plaintiff's claim, and then also, by the way, gets rid of this old rule of abatement that would have applied when the defendant died, whether before or after the death of the injured party. I see my time is up.
It is. Counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Matthew Russert, representing Dr. Siddick. Counsel?
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice. I'm Mike Russert. I represent Affinity Medical Group Incorporated, Affinity Health Systems Incorporated, St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Dr. Almquist, Dr. Haney. I'm speaking on behalf of the respondents. Other respondents, their counsel, are present in the chambers. Attorney Dave Colwin from the Sager firm, representing Dr. Matthew Williams. Attorney Terry Weber from the Nash Spindler firm, representing Dr. Siddiqui and Dr. McAvoy. And Attorney John Thompson, who represents Dr. Frederick Knock in the Medical Protective Company. I have the honor of speaking with you today on behalf of the respondents, and I'd like to go right to the issue of 895.01 sub 1. And I believe that as I prepared to present this case to the court, it occurred to me that the proverbial cart was being placed before the horse, and that the assumption was that Chapter 655 influenced somehow or impacted what happened with Mr. Sanders' claim. And I asked myself, well, what would happen to his claim if this were a non-medical negligence case? And I came to the conclusion that it would extinguish upon his death.
By statute.
By statute.
Express language.
By common law first, and then by the fact that the express language of the survival statute didn't account or allow for his cause of action to survive. And I'll address, Chief Justice, your question about subsection G.
But the express language I'm talking about is in 895.04 that says, see if I can find it again, that if there's no, if there's no surviving minor children, the amount shall be to the spouse. If no spouse, to the deceased lineal heirs. No lineal heirs to the deceased brothers. Then it says, if any such relative dies before judgment in the action, the relative next in order shall be entitled to recover. I mean, that statute expressly. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. It
expressly that says, here's the order, and you gotta live.
Right. That the legislature has created a wrongful death claim and limited it to living relatives.
Does 895.04 sub 2 that I just read apply to 655?
This court has decided in many instances that 655 is not the exclusive statutory scheme for medical negligence cases. For example, 893.55, the statute of limitations is not referred to in Chapter 655, and yet we all agree that that's what applies. I know in the recent case of Sapinski, the court was determining whether the linear heirs would be adopted by the change in would be that the change in the wrongful death statute would be adopted within the Chapter 655 when Chapter 655 specifically referred to the limitations on damages in 895.04.
So what's your answer to my question?
The answer to the question is that it doesn't make a difference in this case. That if you look at his claim extinguishes, and it extinguishes whether or not you say that the claim falls within Chapter 655, because if it falls within 655, the representatives of the estate, they're not listed eligible claimants. And if you look at it more globally and say that, well, you first have to determine what happens to his claim in any instance, the survival statutes don't account for the survival of his action.
Counsel, if I can follow up on the Chief's question. I'm assuming you then agree with opposing counsel that 655.007 is not hierarchical. Is that correct? That Rennick controls.
That's what this court has determined
right.
In the past.
So if it's not hierarchical and a spouse can begin an action and you don't have similar language in 655.007 to the language that's in 895.04 sub 2 that the Chief just read, when you read these statutes together, isn't that suggesting that this separate cause of action for the spouse can continue on through the representatives? Isn't that the message in reading the two statutes together?
I wouldn't come to that conclusion. The conclusion, the 655.007 establishes who are eligible claimants, who can recover in medical negligence cases, and that a spouse can recover, but you know, to paraphrase what the appellant's counsel just said, the way it's always been is that at the death of a spouse, that spouse's claim doesn't survive.
What case says that, that doesn't rely on a statute? What case says that?
What case says that a spouse's claim extinguishes upon death?
Spouse's claim for wrongful death of our husband extinguishes at death.
Well, I don't think there's any claim that says it survives either. I mean,
okay. We don't have case law. Okay.
You have the common law says generally that unless the statute calls for the survival of the action extinguishes upon death. And that theory is pronounced again in the Kranz case.
Kranz, the wrongdoer died, not the claimant.
That's correct. But the court looked at what do we do when someone dies and a case is pending. And the court announced that generally the rule is that the case extinguishes upon the individual's death. That's the common law. And that unless the statute changes that in some way, that's what the law is.
Well, it also says there's a vital distinction between the survival of a cause of action on the death of the injured party.
Right.
And survival of liability on the death of the wrongdoer. And that was a wrongdoer case.
Right.
And did they re-amend the statute? Is that why they amended the statute? This was a 1913 case.
Right. They amended the statute after a second case came down that held the same way. And the death of the injured person, again, is the injured tort victim, not the claimant in a wrongful death claim. Those are separate entities. And
the derivative, though, says derivative, doesn't it? 655 says it's derivative.
655 does. I thought we were talking about the Kranz case.
But it says you're making the point that the husband is not the victim. That's your point. Therefore, the survival cause of action doesn't survive. That's your point.
My point is that the Kranz case, when it talked about the difference between the death of the wrongdoer and the death of the injured person, was referring to the injured person as the person who suffered the tort.
Right, and I'm trying to say that the injured party here is the husband, and that it is having a derivative claim. So if the injured party is a victim and has a claim, and this is derivative, why doesn't it survive?
I'm not sure I'm tracking you.
Okay.
The injured party is not the husband. The injured party was the wife. Okay.
It's one injured party.
Well, I think that's the injured party the Kranz case is talking about, and that's the injured party that's referred to or the Kranz case discusses that is entitled to recover under subsection H in 895.01. Earlier you talked about the survivability or survival claim that Mr. Sanders would have for the pre-death loss of society and companionship of his wife. And you asked counsel, why couldn't that fall under subsection G? Because survival claims have been held to account under and survive under subsection H. So if Mr. Sanders would have died from some person's tortious act, he would be allowed to recover against that tortfeasor for his survival claims under H. But Mr. Sanders' death was a natural death.
Counsel, if I can ask, I want to talk to you about the Kranz case. I'm looking at the decision where it talks specifically about abatement. And the court goes on, and in this connection, it should be observed that there is a vital difference between the survival of a cause of action upon the death of the injured party and a survival of liability upon the death of a wrongdoer. The ground upon which it's been held and an action for wrongful death does not survive the death of the wrongdoer is that it does not accrue until the death of the injured party, and it is then not a devolution of any pre-existing cause of action. Now, in the context of this case, as I understand it, the spouse here has a cause of action under 655.07. If we accept your argument, aren't we then looking at a devolution of a pre-existing cause of action that was disavowed in the Kranz case?
Well, I don't believe so. And again, I go back to looking at this globally. I mean, we seem to be talking about how does 655 impact this man's wrongful death claim, and in the context of a premises liability, an auto accident case, his claim would extinguish upon his death. There is nothing in Chapter 655 which says, under these circumstances, this is a different set of rules, Mr. Sanders' claim won't extinguish. That's not addressed in Chapter 655. And as counsel admitted earlier, then we turn to the Sawyer case and we look at what has the legislature accounted for with respect to survival of actions. I take issue with the grammatical interpretation of sub O, and I would say that on its face, the subsection O says that it only applies to the death of the wrongdoer. If the legislature wanted this to apply to both the death of the claimant and the death of the wrongdoer, it would just end at after the word death. It would say, in addition to the causes of action that survive at common law, all of the following also survive causes of action for wrongful death, period. I disagree that all of these other subsections apply only to the claimants or plaintiffs. I believe that causes of action for assault and battery survive the death of the batterer and the battered. There's nothing to indicate that it only applies to the claimants.
Counselor, why would the legislature have chosen to limit the survival of wrongful death claims to the death of the wrongdoer? What do you think the policy reason underlying that choice is, if I'm to agree with your interpretation?
The same policy reasons that the legislature has decided to limit wrongful death claims to living relatives. If it didn't have the succession section in 895.04 sub 2, you'd have a question as to whether or not the estate would also recover as the claim passed to the estate, and then the relative next in order. The same reason the legislature decided to limit wrongful death claims generally to pecuniary damages. It provided a special exception to certain relationships, spouses, parents, children, minor siblings, and allowed them to claim for loss of society and companionship damages. So it's just an expression of their policy to limit the extent of wrongful death damages.
Counsel, if the surviving spouse has not only loss of society and companionship, but let's say the surviving spouse had a lot of out-of-pocket expenses paid for by, say the spouse is a him, male, so paid for out of his own separate money, that his wife needed extensive health care that wasn't covered by any insurance or other payments. And so he expended, I'll pick a number, $50,000 of out-of-pocket expenses. And then he dies. Now, if he hadn't had to pay that out-of-pocket expense, his estate would be $50,000 wealthier. Is it your position that he dies and that's it? Too bad for that $50,000.
No, my position is that those amounts are recoverable under the estate of Janice Sanders, that husband and wife share in debts and they share in revenue and
In my hypothetical, maybe I wasn't clear enough. I said it was out of his own money. You know, I mean, I'm not talking about any kind of joint money. Get a source that's, you know, clearly his. Some kind of inheritance that was set aside and is clearly his. That's my hypothetical, so I could get around any kind of joint community property.
Okay. Well, 895.04 sub 5 allows the personal representative of the deceased to recover the reasonable cost of medical expenses, funeral expenses, It doesn't indicate that they have to be paid by the deceased or have to be paid by a certain individual. It just allows for the recovery of those damages. There's no specification that it has to be paid by the individual recovering it. In fact,
but we're talking about getting those monies through his estate now, not her estate.
No, I'm saying that those amounts are recoverable through her estate.
I know, but why aren't they, if this is his separate money, not her money at all, his separate money, he pays $50,000, he dies, he would have lived, you know, for the trial in 2 months, no doubt, that was a valid claim, or he could have asserted that claim, and now that $50,000 is gone, poof, and the estate is diminished by the $50,000. His estate is diminished by $50,000. Does that seem right?
But that's the law. And, you know, the counsel provided an example before of the fact that if this case had proceeded to trial and then Mr. Sander died as he did and he didn't live long enough to incur all the damages that had been presented at trial and accepted by the jury but been awarded, the defendants don't have an opportunity to come back to the court and say, I'm sorry, he died earlier, we should get our money back. I mean, that doesn't seem equitable to the defendants, and yet that's the law. That's the way it's always been. And there are inequities on both sides. You know, one of the things that the court, I think, should be reminded of in medical negligence cases is that there are quid pro quos for the opportunity for a claimant to make a claim and be guaranteed insurance. That in order for a healthcare provider to practice medicine in the state of Wisconsin, they have to have primary insurance, and they have to be part of the fund. So this is a unique area of recovery, a unique area of tort, and part of the quid pro quo for that guarantee is that there are certain limitations placed upon recoveries.
Counsel, in you're taking the position that the Kranz case governs both the wrongdoer and the beneficiary. And there's language in it that says that. If the beneficiary dies, too bad. If the wrongdoer dies, too bad. Right?
I'm not saying that the Kranz case addresses the beneficiary. I'm saying that there is no case law or statutory law which says that the beneficiary's claim survives.
Well, in the Kranz case, it referred to Illinois case that said it was held in the Illinois case that under an Illinois statute providing for the survival of an action for injuries to the person, which is what I've been talking about, an action under the death statute survived. And then the court went on to say, it would seem that such a ruling fails to distinguish between the derivative common law action for injury to the person and the statutory action under consideration. And then it says it's not going to take the Illinois law. It's going to take the New York law, et cetera. Then on page 11 of your brief, in your legislative history, I mean, if I'm right about what Kranz does, which
seems to reject the Illinois stance.
Yeah, which means that either one of them dies, that's the end of the case. That was what Kranz seems to say. But then when they brought in the legislative history at page 10, responding to Kranz and Layton, which was the next case, the legislator added this survival, allowing wrongful deaths to survive. And Padway, who introduced it, said, intended to overcome the decision of the Supreme Court in Kranz. So you can interpret that to mean if he was taking that decision literally,
I
covered both.
I would suggest that the Kranz case, that discussion of what the Illinois law was dicta, the holding in Kranz is that there was no provision to allow the claim to survive the death of the wrongdoer.
Because the plaintiff there was alive.
That's correct. And the Boynton case, counsel pointed out the weakness in that case, and that is that it's a workers' compensation case, and the court founded its decision on the basis that the claim was assignable, that because it was a workers' compensation case, that in order to receive the benefits, the employee and its personal representative, his or her personal representative, would have to agree that the claim was assignable to the employer. So the court acknowledged that assignability means survivability. The one thing that hasn't been discussed much this afternoon is the adult daughter's claims. It seems to me that appellants have potentially abandoned their theory that the adult daughters could recover for the death of their mother.
In their own right.
In their own right. It seems to me that position has been abandoned. And so if it has, if the court agrees that it has, then I won't waste the court's time in discussing it.
Is there a case that says adult children don't take under 655?
Well, there are cases that say that adult children don't take. That's correct. The Sapinski court, the Wells estate case says that adult parents don't recover. The Zilkowski case, the Zadzos case, they all discuss the limitations placed upon adult children recovering or parents recovering for adult children. This court has consistently held that loss of society and companionship claims are to be limited between a parent and a child to the age of majority. And I don't see that there's any reason in this case to change that rule. I mean, it's only been since 1975 that this court determined that a parent could recover for the loss in society of companionship of a child for a child's injury.
Well, the title of this case is that they are here as personal representatives of the estate, not in their own individual capacity,
for the wrongful death.
It
says Holly Lawrence individually and as successor special administrator of the mother's estate
right.
And as personal rep of the estate of the father.
That's just one of them. Where's Kim? When Kim individually. Got
also.
It.
Right. So.
Right. Well, we can ask counsel if he's conceding as a matter of law.
Well, I mean, if that's going to occur after I sit down, I'd like to at least address it then a little more.
That's why I asked you what the cases say.
All right. The cases say that it's limited to the age of minority. And again, I think that if you look at this case globally, what would happen in a non-medical malpractice case, it's an unanswered question whether or not adult children can recover under the wrongful death statute for loss of society and companionship. This court in the Estate of Wells case looked at that issue because the petitioner in that case, a mother, was making a claim for an adult child, and she took the stance that after Shockley, the legislature amended the wrongful death statute, and she took the position that the amendment allowed adult children to make claims for loss of society and companionship, and this court said, assuming without holding that the statute allows such recovery, petitioner's reliance is nonetheless misplaced. So it indicates to me that this court didn't say that that's what the law is, that adult children can recover in non-medical negligence cases for the loss of a parent. If you look at the reasoning that this court has expressed in all the different cases that have discussed the relationship between a parent and a child, again, this court has taken the position that this court controls the extent and the limitations on claims for loss of society and companionship, and it has expressed that it is to be limited to certain intimate relationships, including a parent and a spouse, and parents and minor children. And again, I see nothing in this case that would indicate that there's a change, that there should be a change in that public policy decision.
Could I ask you a question about 895.01d?
Sure.
I want to make sure I understand how you think the statute works. If someone is a victim of a battery, and sues, and the tortfeasor dies, what's the result?
It says that the action survives. It doesn't limit the survival to the death of the claimant. It doesn't say that it wouldn't survive upon the death of the tortfeasor either. While 895.01(1)(o) does specifically limit its application to the death of the wrongdoer.
But who has a cause of action? I always thought the plaintiff had the cause of action.
Right, but, you know, I guess the Kranz case was an example where the cause of action was extinguished when the wrongdoer died. And the court and the legislature corrected that by saying that the cause of action doesn't extinguish when if the wrongdoer dies, and we've made a legislative announcement to that effect.
But if the wrongdoer dies on an assault and battery, that's okay? The cause of action proceeds?
Because it's allowed to survive under the statute.
Under D. What does 2 mean? What does subsection 2 mean?
That any other event doesn't cause the action to abate if it's also allowed to survive. I'm not offering a suggestion as to what other event could be.
Yeah, I thought that causes of action here were all for the plaintiff. The plaintiff can let those go, even if the plaintiff doesn't survive. And then under 2, if the defendant dies, that's another cause of action, and that plaintiff's action can proceed.
Well, the Kranz case would say that's not the case. In that instance, it wasn't the claimant who died or the plaintiff who died. It was the wrongdoer who died, and the court said, unless the legislature allows it to survive, it doesn't.
Counsel, I want to follow up Justice Prosser's question, and I think this ties into a question asked earlier by Justice Rovensack. It's your position that 895.011A through N, that those causes of action survive the claimant's death and survive the wrongdoer's death. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But with regard to O, it's your interpretation that the cause of action survives only the wrongdoer's death.
Because the legislature has placed language there limiting its application.
Well, let's say that I'm not sure what this says. Let's just say there's some ambiguity. You know, it may be unambiguous, but let's say there's some ambiguity. Then you get to why. I have a hard time understanding why the legislature would make the kind of rule that you're advancing it clearly states.
Well, potentially it's because wrongful death claims are inherently limited. They're limited to the living relatives. So if they allowed the cause of action to survive the death of the claimant, they would be in contrast to their expression of the limitations of the wrongful death claims that are set forth in 895.04.
Wrongful death claims are not inherently limited vis-a-vis a claim being brought on behalf of the estate by the representative of the estate. There's no limitation with regard to that.
I'm not sure I understand your point.
I thought your answer was, well, look, causes of action for wrongful death have limitations. Limitations as to living relatives, limitations as to linear, limitations as to, you know, familial relationships. My point is, if you're bringing a cause of action on behalf of the estate, you can be almost a stranger to the estate, appointed representative of the state, and be asserting an action on behalf of the estate. You don't need any familial relationship whatsoever.
That's correct.
So why can't this estate, I don't understand. Vis-a-vis an estate, does this make any sense?
The estate is bringing a claim for the survival actions of the deceased.
That's right.
The claims that survive under H, under 895.01(1)(h). That's what the estate is bringing, those survival claims. So any Any person that is eligible to be a personal representative can bring those claims.
Well, but don't those claims, why don't those claims include a wrongful death claim?
Why don't they? Because the legislature wouldn't have enacted a separate subsection to say this is what happens to wrongful death claims if all of these other subsections, or some of them, G and H, would include wrongful death. Again, statutory construction.
I'm not saying G and H do. I mean, I think all relates to wrongful death.
Right.
And I just don't understand, vis-a-vis an estate claim, what sense this makes if your interpretation prevails.
Well, wrongful death is divided into two separate claims, an estate's claim for the survival of the actions and the claims for the beneficiaries of a wrongful death claim.
That's why I say vis-a-vis the estate's claim. That's what I'm talking about here.
Well, the person has already died. So there wouldn't be a survival of an action of someone who's already died. The statutory structure allows for someone to bring a claim on behalf of the estate and have that, there's no question that that claim would proceed through judgment no matter what happened. A successor personal representative would be named, as was in this case. There is no claim in this case that the daughters are ineligible successor representatives. Mrs. Sanders' claim continues.
Counselor, if I understand what you're saying then, you're telling us that the reason sub O is limited to the death of the wrongdoer is because if we included in sub O or some other provision of 895.01 the plaintiff's claims, that would then conflict with the succession outlined in 895.04 sub 2. Because if you keep the claim going under, the estate's claim going under 895.011, some subparagraph, pick one, then you can't enact the succession that is set out in 895.04 sub 2.
That's another reason to understand that O is limited to just the death of the wrongdoer.
Yeah, thank you.
Except a more specific statute covers the general survivor statute under general construction rules. And what's 895's introductory provisions say?
895. 04 or 01?
Doesn't say. Doesn't relate to whether other statutes that may conflict.
Okay.
It's fine.
I see that I'm out of time.
Right. Counsel,
thank you
very much. Mr. Lauffenberg.
Thank you. Anticipating the question the court would have for me about the claims of the adult children in this situation, the court will note that part of the appendix to the plaintiff's brief or the appellant's brief is the amended complaint that was filed on behalf of the adult children after their father's death. And they did in that complaint assert claims for their own loss of their own society and companionship with their mother, recognizing that the case law, namely Saplinsky, has held that those claims don't exist in a medical malpractice context. I disagree with counsel that they don't exist in a non-medical malpractice context. I've tried a number of those cases and have never had the argument made that adult children don't have a right to
recover. This is medical malpractice.
That's correct.
Do they have those claims as adult children, aside from their interests through the estate?
No. Under Saplinsky, they don't. But I would suggest, if the court's going to say, are we abandoning those, they are not being abandoned in the sense that we give up on them. We're simply saying that under the current case law, they can't pursue those claims. And if this court were to reconsider that case law, which I would be happy to see occur, I think that you'd want to have additional briefs on that subject. That issue was not briefed in this case, and the court may choose not to address it here because it wasn't briefed, or may send it back for briefs to the Court of Appeals on that subject for whatever enlightenment that process might provide. But then answering Justice Rogensack's question and to an extent Justice Bradley's question, the why, I agree, it doesn't make sense. that the legislature would provide for a recovery to a spouse who loses a spouse by medical malpractice, and yet intend that the damages actually incurred disappear when that spouse might happen to die before judgment. It doesn't make any sense. And neither does the old common law rule of abatement. As you can see, that common law rule of abatement has really no place in modern law because the legislature has consistently shown that it doesn't like the rule. And it's a common law rule which this court can change and modify, as it did in Boynton, to fit the circumstances, and particularly in this case, where the legislature has provided that a spouse can make a derivative claim for the death of a patient by malpractice, it conflicts with the public policy underlying that Chapter 655 that those damages ought to be paid, and that the issue ought to be litigated so that it can deter the medical malpractice which caused those damages. And absent that, there's no compensation, and there's no deterrence, and there's no public policy interest. I disagree with counsel that there is some public policy interest in allowing that claim to disappear upon death. Clearly, nobody could contend that the numbers of claims that are going to be brought by spouses who happen to die before their cases get to verdict is going to have any significant impact on the cost of health care, the cost of medical malpractice insurance, the number of the availability of medical malpractice insurance, the continued ability of doctors to practice in this state. There aren't going to be a lot of those claims. And if this, inconsistent with this court's approach in the Ferdin case, where it found there wasn't a rational basis to impose upon the limited number of people who had the most serious injuries a cap on recovery, there certainly isn't any rational basis for imposing on the limited number of spouses who are going to die before judgment in their case a burden of losing the benefit of their incurred damages, even though those damages are going to go to the estate of that spouse rather than to them personally. It doesn't make any sense for that to happen. So I don't think there is a good reason in public policy or in the statutory provisions to say that the old common law rule of abatement, to the extent that it still has any application, is going to require that Mr. Sanders' claim for damages actually incurred, and that we're not claiming anything beyond, if this case goes to trial, the case will be limited to.
Counselor, would you agree with me that if we were not talking about Med-Mal, so we can set aside those cases that differentiate who can be a claimant, if we are not talking about Med-Mal, that you could not interpret 895.0110 to include a plaintiff's claim without creating a conflict with the succession set out in 895.04 sub 2.
Exactly, and as Justice Abramson pointed out, the more specific statute will control. It doesn't mean that that provision wouldn't apply, but there is a more specific statute to that situation which would control. What I think really
happened. What's the more specific statute?
895.04 sub 2, which more specifically says what happens in a wrongful death case that is not a malpractice case.
Right. I think that we're in agreement on that. But I guess my concern comes back to the fact that you argue that we should look to 895.01 for some guidance on what to do here as the statute that creates a right of succession. But we can't interpret that statute one way for wrongful death and the same words in the same statute in another way for wrongful death that's outside of a medical malpractice practice context,
And I ask why not, because this court has consistently done that in the Chapter 655 context, that Chapter 655 has a legislative creative right of action to which 895.04 sub 2 doesn't apply, and therefore we look to the general survivorship statute for guidance as to whether those claims were intended to survive.
I don't know about guidance so much as direction. Does it tell
and
us
I think it does provide
not?
Direction. I think it very clearly says that causes of action
so
for wrongful death.
You would want us to interpret subsection O one way in Med-Mal and subsection O a different way when we don't have a Med-Mal wrongful death?
No, I think the court would be compelled to follow the legislative mandate of 895.04 sub 2 in a non-medical malpractice death case.
Right, and I'm not having a problem with that. My problem is here today we got a wrongful death claim in a Med-Mal case, and are you not asking me to interpret the subsection 895.01 sub 10 or O differently now than you would if this were not a medical malpractice?
No, I think the interpretation is the same. The application is different because this happens to be a case which isn't covered by 895.04 sub 2. You have to look to 895.01 sub
0. Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're saying we just X out the 895.04 sub 2 if we're in Med-Mal and we interpret subsection 1 of the survivor, 1.0 of the survivorship statute to include more now than it would if we had to link it to the other statute.
That's correct.
Okay, I understand better. Thanks an awful lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Laufenberg, and thank you, Mr. Russert, for your arguments today in yet another Med-Mal wrongful death case. They've been enlightening, and so ends our hearing on 05AP2315 Lawrenson versus Sitiqui et al. That ends this hearing. We'll take a short recess, so those who wish to leave may do so, and there are other students waiting to enter the chambers. We are in recess.